denied a bank loan.
All right. How's he start? San Diego? Is he stay classy? What's the start?
That's his sign off.
Oh, yeah. what's the sign in? This is all staying in the podcast, by the way.
It's like a good morning San Diego type of thing, I think.
All right. Good morning, San Diego. Okay. Welcome to the Hips Hit podcast with me, Rabbi Simcha, on the couch with my best friend, Saul Sudan.
It's a pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure to be here. Okay.
It is. My first time at your home.
First time.
Your new home.
The new home. We broke bread today together, bagels. You went for the scallion cream cheese. How was that?
It was delicious. Thank
really?
You.
Really? Yep. Okay. I do have, when you're ready, by the way, the chocolate peanut butter croissant.
Okay.
So when you're ready.
I think I can psych myself up.
To take this to the next level, we will do it. So, Saul, thank you for coming over. I recently purchased some podcast kit to take the Hips Hit podcast to the next level. As Saul, you are well aware of, we have many thousands of listeners all over the world. You being one of them.
One of them, yeah.
Have you ever listened to the Hips Hit podcast?
Yes, I have.
Whatever. Which one?
Something like a while ago, maybe when you were first starting and you were still working with Sherry and it was early on.
Okay. All right. Very good. And so you kindly came over today to break bread. Have we seen each other since the world imploded?
I want to say we've seen each other once.
Crazy.
Yeah.
Crazy. Okay, so you came over to help me. I don't know what wire goes in which socket. No. I don't know what a level is. You came over, and if you're coming over, how can we not podcast? And how have you not possibly been on the Hips Hit podcast? How's that possible?
It's a good question. Possibly between me being busy with two small children and work.
Let's go to origins. Saul, for the listener, or the thousands of listeners out there, what's the origin story of the Saul Sudan Rabbi Simcha Love Fest, which is now in its, what year?
Oh, God. 17 years?
17 years, okay. Let's go back to year one.
So
pre-Simcha.
I was a student at Pratt Institute, where you have been a rabbi for all this time. And I was Jewish. I had come out of spending a little time in yeshiva in Israel and had a Jewish background. And I was trying to find a thing to connect to on campus because my parents told me I should. And, you know, to some extent, I wanted to as well. But, you know, you're in college and you're exploring and you're figuring things out.
Getting very nostalgic now.
Right?
And Dan Berg suddenly looms large in the origins.
So I met Dan Berg my freshman year. He was a friend of a friend, and then we became friends. And in our sophomore year, because there was nothing going on campus Jewishly besides a couple people that I knew, and we would occasionally have dinner, that he brought you to the shul. To the school from B'nai Avraham, the shul that you were working at the time. We actually had a phone conversation.
You talk about this. I have no recollection.
Okay. My mom, again, wanting me to have
a Jewish
connection on campus. She found B'nai Avraham.
Just for the listener, B'nai Avraham is the synagogue in Brooklyn Heights under the leadership of the majestic, mighty Rabbi Raskin. I was a fresh off the boat Baal Tshuva, still wet behind the ears. I'd also done the Israel learning thing. Our paths are so interconnected and interwoven, I don't even know where to begin. And Rabbi Raskin had empowered me and entrusted me to dip my toe into campus rabbinics. Pratt were looking for a rabbi. I was looking for a job. I'd recently got married. My recollection is that I was unleashed unknowingly onto the young minds on the college campus.
It's all thanks to Dan Berg.
Right.
Who kind of made that connection. We were not that different. Right. Yeah, I mean, you're basically like a brother to me because we could be brothers.
We both have this background in film. You were studying film.
I was studying film.
I had studied film.
Yes. Okay. And you had worked in the film industry.
You
love to tell stories about the films that you worked on in Britain.
Doesn't quite have the same cachet, although they're becoming retro.
Oh, so everyone's into the Spice Girls again. It's okay.
Who was not into the Spice Girls?
Right.
It
comes back around.
So your mother had called up the synagogue and said,
my son's looking for
Saul
Jewish connection.
Needs some Yiddishkeit.
Right. She wanted me to find Jewish food on campus because there was no Jewish meal plan, anything like that, etc. So we spoke on the phone once, and I probably gave you the same treatment that I gave most rabbis I spoke to on the phone at that time, which is, yes, okay, thank you.
Goodbye.
And goodbye, yeah. And then I didn't see you or speak to you again for maybe 2 years.
There you go.
And then Dan brought you to the campus, and together with our friend Scott Yehannick, he had a Jewish student union that began to blossom.
Right. We launched Jewish Life in Pratt Institute.
Yeah.
So I'd give you my recollection of meeting you, and you could tell me how true, whether this is like history or...
Legend.
Legend. Thank you. I recall sniffing around the campus, move-in day, 2000 and something, and your father was helping you move in. And I remember saying to your father, don't worry, we're going to find him a nice Jewish girl.
Yes.
That's my recollection of the origin story.
That was, I believe, the beginning of my junior year. And so you had been at the campus maybe like the back half of the previous semester.
Sniffing around.
You had, I think, maybe one event during that time. I met you in brief during that time, but you didn't really know me.
Right.
And then you saw me, a young guy wearing
young,
a kippah.
Impressionable.
Yeah. And
wearing a kippah. My judah was tingling. And like a young Chabad Freddy Krueger, I looked at you and I felt how sweet fresh meat.
Exactly. I remember your eldest child was in the pram. You were walking around.
He was with me, right?
Yes. Ariella was with you too.
Mendel was in the pram.
Yeah.
Mendel is in the room next to us right now in college doing
still
his
in
homework.
The pram. Yeah.
Mendel, you're doing your homework? Okay, that didn't quite go the way I thought. All right, and then we started Jewish Life at Pratt, and at that time, it was just me, you, and Dan Burke.
Well, there were a few
Elke was in the school at that point?
No, no.
Okay.
She came my senior year.
We're going to get into the nice Jewish girl that I promised you and your father in a second.
It's true,
okay.
It's true.
Right? Rabbi Simcha delivers. Let's just put that out there.
Simcha Prime.
Yeah, I promise every single freshman father, don't worry, we'll find your child a nice Jewish girl or boy. So we started to build up Jewish Life.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so there were some other key people who showed up around that time, but it really blossomed my senior year.
Right.
And
we hit the stride.
Yeah, exactly. And when Elke, my wife, came to the campus, you were established enough at that point that you had a presence.
Right.
You were there for...
I was giving out the
Club
Frisbees.
Gay.
That
yes.
was the year?
That was the year of the Frisbee.
Explain the Frisbee.
You were handing out a Frisbee on Club Day, which is like first week of school. People are getting their bearings. And the Frisbee said, get high on Judaism.
Why did I do that?
Because you thought it was funny.
Right. It's kind of funny.
The same reason why Chabad in Israel had signs that said pot.
Chabad put on tefillin.
It's just to catch people's eye.
So I'm handing out the Frisbees. My recollection was that Elke came onto the campus like a wrecking ball. Suddenly, there was this very Jewy, very excitable hippie with dreadlocks. She had dreadlocks at the time, right?
Yes, she did.
She had dreadlocks, and Elke was all in. She was like, that's it. And I felt Elke took it to the next level.
She did. She encouraged friends of hers to come.
Right. At that time, I was living in Brooklyn Heights by Rabbi Raskin. And you would come with Elke and the crew Friday night.
Yeah, it was a whole group of people.
Who was in the crew in those days?
Well, Asia, Dan.
Shout out to Asia.
Yeah.
Asia Cohen now.
Asia Cohen now. Or I should say Sivan Cohen, formerly Asia Kalvidi.
She goes by Sivan?
I mean, it's her Hebrew name.
Transcendent.
Everyone's got multiple names now, right?
All right.
There was Ariana.
Ariana I still talk to. Julie, I still talk to.
I believe you talk to most people.
I really do.
Yeah.
Unlike a lot of the Chabad rabbis that have their Chabad family, my Shlichas family is my family.
Yeah.
So.
There was Yuri from Metro Tech.
Still talk to Yuri.
Nice. There was Nachi from Brooklyn Law.
Don't talk to Nachi. Sorry, Nachi.
Sorry,
love
Nachi.
You.
We miss you, Nachi.
We miss you.
Yeah, there were a lot of people.
Right.
And.
Those were wild nights, right?
Wild nights, yeah.
There was some tomfoolery.
Yeah.
Some tomfoolery. Let's leave it at that.
But people had a good time.
It was a flood one Friday. Were you there when there was a flood?
Yes.
Right.
I do remember. But every week had its adventure. Right. And
no chairs, no spoons, no forks.
Right.
I didn't know what I was doing. I wasn't trained in campus rabbinics. In a weird way, I had spent my time in an art school. Suddenly, I'm the rabbi of the art school, so I could talk about, you know, Mishnah or Evil Dead Part 2. And I think we spent a lot of time talking about the latter. So what are your recollections of those nights?
My recollections are that we would talk about movies, and no one else would know what the hell we were talking about. And you know, it was just that thing that you and I could share.
Right.
Similarly, comic books. We would talk a lot about comic books. And... you know, it was out of those conversations that you wrote your book.
Right. No joke.
Up in Oive.
It began, when I speak, I tell the story. This book began over copious bowls of chicken soup at 2 o'clock in the morning with Saul. And the crowds are like, ha ha, you know, he's being cute. No.
Right. No, that's true.
That's where it's. And by the way, those conversations, think about it, took me to the going to the conventions. This is pre-Marvel Cinematic Universe. And it led me to write about Jewish influences on superheroes and superhero academics and mythology, which led to the book, which led to the book tours, which led clearly to the Marvel Cinematic Universe, because without me
direct,
and you...
Direct connection.
Exactly. Where would Iron Man be? I mean, he owes it all to us. Now, that conversation is canon and can be found on Disney+.
It's true.
Right?
Yeah. I have to tell you that last year when you appeared in that documentary, what was it called, Behind the Mask?
Yes.
Okay. So when you were in Behind the Mask on Disney+, I sat down and watched it, and I was crying. Because not only is it a beautiful documentary, and I work in documentary, and I really care about these things, but seeing you on the big screen on Disney+, a major subscription service that has millions and millions of people watching it, I was just like, not only taken back to those conversations,
right,
but I was like, oh, you really did it. Like, you really accomplished it. You're the guy. When people want to talk Jews and comic books, there's a handful of names. But you're the guy who's in that documentary.
I'm the guy.
Yeah.
That and a Metro card, Saul, will get me to Midtown. But I have to tell you that, like most things, forward motion is everything. So when I was asked to be in the documentary, I didn't really ruminate too much about it. It was like 3 hours of my life in a warehouse in Dumbo, and I'd sort of put it to bed and forgot it existed. Then when the documentary came out and I got a call from the director about it, by the way, I have his card, he wants to talk, so you never know. You never know. Robert Downey Jr. is out of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, so...
Could be you. You're next.
It probably not. But when I saw it, it did sort of like... give a little bit of legitimacy to our conversations. And I was like, oh, you know, this is kind of canon now. The whimsy,
for sure. Yeah.
The whimsy that we had is now law. So
it's true. At the time, you know, it was a thing to talk about that, gee, there are a lot of interesting stories behind these Jews who created these characters, but no one was popularizing it to the same degree. People weren't analyzing it to the same degree. There was some psychology that people who were interested in it were finding. But that documentary really gets into it, not only with Judaism, but a number of cultures and identities.
Right, right. What about your background in comic books, film?
So I grew up in St. Louis, Missouri, and I was always an artistic kid. I just gravitated towards that.
Right.
And
a dreamer.
Yeah, exactly.
Star Wars, Jaws,
comic books. I didn't see Jaws until later, but
get out of here.
It's true. But lots of things, Transformers and
yes,
Batman for sure. Batman the Animated Series, Who Framed Roger Rabbit,
great movie.
Gremlins 2. I'm trying to think of the things that really changed my life.
They went Gremlins 2. No one goes Gremlins 2. They go Gremlins 1. But okay,
no, Gremlins 2: The New Batch is way better. It's
really
it's shocking
how
amazing that movie is.
Controversial. You hit it on the Hipson podcast.
Yeah, thank you.
Saul Soothan just laid down a shocker.
Well,
Gremlins
talking about
2, The New Batch, is a better movie than Gremlins.
It is.
This is a...
There's a handful of sequels that are better than the first. That's one of them. Terminator 2, also a big influence on me as a child.
Godfather Part 2, which we'll
Godfather
talk about in
2,
a minute. Okay.
Yeah, for sure.
Yep.
Empire Strikes Back, you know.
So you're a child of cinema.
Yeah. And
as was I, which I think led to us having such a deep and rich and continuing friendship.
And I had a friend who lived across the street whose older brother read comics. Keep in mind, this is the early 90s. Right. X-Men is now the biggest thing in the world, at least to a kid of that age.
Right.
It was the launch of the new X-Men book, a second X-Men book.
Right.
Just called X-Men. Jim Lee's the artist. You know, these things are happening. And then a bunch of famous artists from Marvel and DC, or mostly Marvel at that time, leave and they start their own company called Image Comics. And the comic book industry was just blooming. You had the death of Superman at that time.
Right.
And it was on the news. Everyone was talking about comic books.
Right.
And they were selling big numbers. Right. It didn't translate to TV and movies at that time.
Right.
It was just the books themselves, which is an interesting difference now. Anyway, so I got obsessed with comic books, and I started a collection, and I would just read them all the time. And, you know, to tie that into my Jewish story, like, you know, I could go into a lot about how I was raised, but my dad is from a Reformed family, and my mom was raised without a Jewish identity, became religious later in life when she had kids. She was the one who became Orthodox and really drove my siblings and I getting a Jewish education and making sure that we understood Judaism. But it was hard for me. I'm the youngest of three. And again, a dreamer, creative. Friday nights, I would rather be sitting in my room reading comic books than anything else. That was my thing. So
to go to art school, meet the rabbi who, you know.
Exactly. So for me, it was, you know, every summer was take comic book illustration classes. I didn't want to go to summer camp, that kind of thing. And I thought I was going to be a comic book illustrator until I was 16, wrote my first screenplay, and I decided I'm going to go into film. So I started watching every movie I could get my hands on. I used my local library, you know, go down the list of 200 most classic, famous, best movies of all time kind of thing, and watch them all. And that's what I was when you met me, basically. I was just obsessed with all of those things, and was ready to start creating something worthwhile myself.
Oh, you actually just described very succinctly my childhood. However, when I became a rabbi, I sort of was like, oh no, I gotta burn the Beatles. I gotta hide Who Framed Roger Rabbit. If I suddenly mention Ghostbusters, I'm going to be put in Harem. And then I met you, and we were able to kind of eke out a Jewish undertone and a shared narrative to these stories. And dude, I love you very much. Okay.
Thank you. I love you too.
This is now the love fest part of the podcast. I do this in all of the shows that you've not listened to. I declare my love for the guest. Then you met Elky.
Yes. So
elaborate.
In the long term, yes. You followed through on your promise.
I did follow through.
And
let it be known.
And so the funny thing is, I was not interested in her as a romantic person at all when we first met. She was, as we said, a hippie girl with dreads. And I was more dark and brooding and was in love with film noir and walking around wearing a trench coat and fedora kind of person.
Still do, actually.
Truth. And I just had bigger sideburns back then.
Right. Definitely had that Wolverine vibe.
Yes, it's true. Yes. That year, junior year, I had the Wolverine thing going on. So, which, that's a whole other thing. I could launch into a whole thing. I'll just do a short version.
Right.
Wolverine is a character from the comics who is 5'3", if that. He's got big hairy chops. He's hairy black hair. He's tough and he's small and he's rough. And the movies have made him out to be Hugh Jackman, who is
ripped,
6 foot whatever, and ripped. And he's, you know, more sexy. And I am disappointed in that, because Wolverine means a lot to me as someone who is the size and attitude and hair style of Wolverine.
It's back to Elky.
Yeah, okay. So, Elky and I met on campus.
I can tell you the way I remember it. I don't know if you want me to tell you, but you tell me your version.
I'll tell you Elky's version first.
Okay.
Elky's version is she walked in
to, like, that show, Scenes from a Marriage. Okay. This is Elky's perspective.
We're going to flashback to the flashback to the flashback, and we'll keep Inception-ing it. So Elky's version is that she walked in on a Tuesday when you were hosting a pizza lunch, or a sushi that day, actually. It was a Tuesday.
Really?
You had sushi.
Still do that.
And she walked in and she saw me with my blue leather coat and fedora. And
sideburns.
And sideburns.
She thought, wow, Wolverine.
No, she saw me joking with you, actually, and she was like, who's this guy who's so close with the rabbi?
Right.
And she was curious about that, I think.
Wow.
And so, you know, we just had a very casual presence with one another, as we still do. And my version is that, yeah, she was this hippie girl, and she was nice. I liked her, but I wasn't interested in her romantically, and she was also seeing someone at the time, and I wasn't going to swoop in and try and do something about that.
Okay.
But I was going to a concert in a couple weeks with some of my friends, and her favorite band was playing in that festival show.
Which band?
Yeah, Belle and Sebastian. It was Beck and Belle and Sebastian and the Polyphonic Spree and a bunch of other bands at Coney Island. And so she found out I was going. She didn't know anyone else who was going, and she decided to get a ticket and join us. So she tagged along with myself and a couple of my close friends. That was the first time we hung out for real. And otherwise, we would see each other on Friday nights or Tuesday for lunch because of the JSU.
Right.
And so getting back to some of those very funny, fun Friday nights, the walk from your apartment in Brooklyn Heights back to the Pratt campus was about a half hour. And everyone would be just kind of stumbling home and laughing and talking. And so over the course of those conversations, she and I got to know each other better. And it was at some point during the winter that we started to really know each other and realized we had a close connection about just who we were in life and the way we were raised, the types of families that we came from, and what that meant for our personalities and things like that. And so, you know, there was one time, it must have been towards the end of the semester, where we sat on the campus and we just sat there.
Whereabouts on the campus?
I want to say it was like after Sukkot and the sukkah was still up.
Oh.
Because that was another thing. Second day of Rosh Hashanah, she and I were the only two people from Pratt who came to the shul where you were working. First day of Rosh Hashanah, a bunch of people show up. That's normal. Everyone does one day. But if you show up the second day, that's a bigger deal. You're more hardcore. We had a really meaningful experience. Both of us, like, we shared that. And so we were able to, like, bond over that as well. So at some point, it's a Friday night, post-Sukkot, and it's cold. I remember that. And we're sitting on the campus.
Made a move.
And no. We sat and we talked. Like, everyone else dispersed from the group that came back to the campus and went their separate ways to go to a party or go to sleep or whatever.
Right.
And she and I just sat there talking more and more and more. And we really just got to know each other. By the time the fall semester ended, we had gotten to know each other pretty well. And we went our separate ways for winter break. And then when I came back, she was back in town before school started again, like the week before. I had a friend who was in town, and we started hanging out then also. And that's when it started to twist towards the romantic. And
I like that phrase, twist towards the romantic.
Yeah, it's true.
Very chivalrous. It's true. Okay.
So it was Valentine's Day.
Whoa.
When we really acknowledged our romantic interest for each other. I mean, it was like that weekend. And she had to make a decision. And so she chose me.
Wow. Look at you.
Yeah.
My recollection was it was Friday night, and it just seemed apparent and clear to everyone at the table that this couple were destined to be together. There was like an energy. There was a connection. There was like a connective tissue. And I remember me and Mike Cohen leaning over to you and saying, dude, you got to date this girl.
Yeah,
and
I remember that.
You saying,
No, she
has a boyfriend. Ordinarily, that would be where I would stop, but they just, me and Mike were like, dude, when was the wedding?
The wedding was July of 2007.
Okay, beautiful.
And so we dated for 10 months and then got engaged, and then the wedding was,
wow, it was so quick.
7 months after that, yeah. Yeah. It was like basically 17 months from the time that we decided to start dating to the wedding.
Beautiful.
Yeah. And now it's been almost 15 years.
Emotional now. And I remember the wedding was awesome. There's two things about the wedding that stands out. You know, the first one was when your father launched into this rendition of not Soul Man, but Soul Man.
Yes. Soul Man was a song that my dad and my brother had recorded for my bar mitzvah originally. A take on the Blues Brothers version of Soul Man.
Right.
And they came out in black hats and black sunglasses and black suits with skinny ties. And they danced and they did the whole thing.
It was a fun wedding.
It was the Jews brothers.
It was
actually
a fun wedding. Great food. Remember that? I think at this point, like, you were just so loved as a couple, and that it was a small community. We were so close. We were all so close in age that it was just a magical time. I'm looking back now. I mean, like, one of those movies. It was a beautiful time, right?
It was. And I'm still very close with a number of people from that time.
Right. And then you settled in downtown Brooklyn, not far from the campus. Still there.
So at the time, my wife was still in school, and we were now part of this synagogue community in Brooklyn Heights.
Right.
So we found an apartment that was in between those things, and we've been there ever since, basically.
Wow. I really credit you and Elke for, like, being the founding Avraham and Sarah, the matriarch and patriarch of what today is Jewish life at Pratt. It led to the opening of a center on campus. It led to a hub of art and culture. And I felt like we, I wouldn't say changed the world, but I think we put a shtickle imprint indelibly onto Jewish life in downtown Brooklyn. What are your recollections of kind of those years?
I would also just say that there were a lot of other people who contributed.
It's like classic soccer teams. When Alex Ferguson, who I despise, was the manager at Man United, you know, there are certain teams that stick out. So, but you were the OGs.
Yeah, so there have been different eras of people, plenty of people who've contributed over time. You and Ariella set the tone for what things would be, and I was just hanging out. I don't feel like I did much. Elke did tons.
I was the guy behind the scenes.
And you would come back. I mean, it's very rare that a campus rabbi still has students coming for dinner that had graduated 10 years, 15 years, 17 years. So that was kind of magical to watch. And now, kids.
Yeah. Well, at a certain point, your community evolved and more families. And so it wasn't just about the campus anymore.
They were getting married. They were sticking around. They were.
Yeah, exactly. It was a beautiful blossom to this day. Continues. And I still think of it as a wonderful time. Beautiful. In some ways, I kind of have a sadness about it because that era has ended. You don't have the same presence at the synagogue anymore. And a lot of families have moved away.
Right.
As much as we all might. But that's just the reality of growing up.
But we're still interconnected. Even like subtle things. Like a student in the class last week mentioned Owen Wilson. And it reminded me of 10 years ago, Ali Speckler's mother met Owen Wilson. So I get on the phone to Ali Speckler, who's in Germany at an arts internship. And we're talking about Mindy's meeting 10 years prior. I don't know, there's just a kind of connective tissue that we all have. And the fact that we've evolved and we've grown, and I think it's important to not be static, and things need to move and need to grow. And I think it's important to let youth find its feet, put its own imprint. The fact that we're all still schmoozing, it's a beautiful thing, dude.
It is. It shows how much people really care about each other. We were all there because we wanted to be there. No one was forced.
Right.
I think that's also a tone that you set, which is we all know that Judaism can be full of rabbis or various other people who expect you to be there and who guilt you into being there. And your version of it was come because you want to be here. Try to have a good time. We know that there are things that are hard or problematic, and we're going to talk about that, and we're just going to let it out. We don't need to hide behind the mask. We don't need to show up to Rosh Hashanah with the newest, latest, greatest suit to show off what money you have, or how powerful you are, and whatever else. You can just be you. That's who I want. I want you for your soul, for who you really are.
Wow.
That's the vibe that I always got from you.
I think what you're trying to say nicely, there's a low barrier to entry. I kept the bar low, I lowered expectations, and I delivered. So I have tears in my eyes, as do you right now. I don't know what to say. Movies. Movies are great. So we've always had this connection over cinema. I think we have a love of Judaism and a love of cinema. And I love Judaism. Love it. Love the holidays. Love the celebration, and I love just the people. And what I liked about what we've done over the years is to have such like a diverse, and that was so unique to the neighborhood. And I think we have to mention Sholi Lemberger. The dynamics of the campus is such that you have sort of the Berkeley of Brooklyn. You have this very liberal, open, creative, you know, artistic, hub of creatives. And then on the block, on Taffy, is the beginnings of the Hasidic Haredi Satmar community. It is a mix that you don't see even in Israel. And it has led and continues to lead to some very unique interactions.
So the loft buildings on Taffy, Residences, were built my freshman year. So that was kind of the beginning of Pratt's informal expansion in that way. I lived in a building called the Bomber Building my senior year. And that building was at the corner of Willoughby and Klassen. You had, on one half, there were, I believe, condos that were sold to the Satmar community. Right. Everyone on that side of the building with its own separate entrance, with access to the courtyard, that was a Satmar building.
Full on.
Full on. And then...
Shul in the basement.
Yes. And then around the corner, separate entrance, same building, apartments that were rented out to whomever.
Right.
And that whomever included myself and my roommates.
Were you there at the Seder when we finished the wine that year?
No.
Oh, there was one Seder. It was a Pratt Seder. We were doing everything in the chapel. I said, you may now drink the first cup. Gone. All the wine. That's it. Three cases. Done. Gone. Doom. And I'm like, we got three more, you know, I don't know what to do. So I believe it was me and Dan Berg just start knocking on doors. The Hasidim can be segregated and can be perhaps private. There's sometimes a wall. When you break that wall, and when you open that door, which I think is something that we did, by the way. Now, the coolest thing is hipster Hasidim. You know, everyone knows the whole...
There's a podcast called Hipsid.
We opened a porthole, by the way. So we were knocking on doors at that Seder, cold. And Chevra would just give us, like, a case of wine.
Yeah.
Can you have a bottle? Here's a case.
Extremely kind people.
So let's get into Sholi Lamberger.
So I had a roommate in the Bomber Building. She would always ask me things about Judaism because... she would be exposed to certain things from the Satmars who lived next door. Like, for example, on Sukkot, they were building all these shacks outside in the courtyard or on their balconies and things. And what are they doing? They're singing all night. What is this? And so I would explain Sukkot things. Sholi Lamberger was a gentleman who lived with his family in that side of the building. And he one time was hanging out front, probably smoking a cigarette. And my roommate came over and was smoking a cigarette with him. And they started chatting. And through that roommate, I met Sholi, because she was like, I just met this Satmar Chassid guy. And I'm like, really? One of them talked to you? That's interesting, because normally they keep to themselves.
I know people that became Jewish because Sholi Lamberger was smoking a cigarette on the street and someone asked for a light.
Yeah.
To cut a long story short, became Jewish, lives in Sfas. So, no one. I mean, so that's Sholi.
Yeah. So special he was guy. Just very kind. And I got to know him better as a neighbor. And I got to know him better.
And he would have you over for meals.
Yes. I had meals at his home.
We opened a porthole.
It was amazing. His entire family are beautiful people. Obviously, his sister became a big part of the community. Right. I got to know his mother a little
see that,
bit.
See that? This chair. One second.
What does this chair say?
The chair says Shadchan.
That's the chair that Sholi's sister, Fagi, gave me at her wedding that I had made the shidduch. So that's the connection with the Lambergers.
You've made a lot of shidduchs.
There you go.
You get into heaven for free now, right?
I can get into heaven, yes. I could use the VIP bathroom in heaven.
That's amazing.
There you go.
I'm going to be like the Yaakov. I'm just going to like hold on to your ankle.
That's it.
That's my best bet.
Executive bathroom.
So Sholi Lamberger, he's a very beautiful person.
Right.
And
the best.
And he really, I think, was responsible for a lot of that opening up between the communities of the
Cholent,
art school.
All of these...
Yes, Thursday night children.
Off all of these, off the you know, grid portholes, conversations. Wow, this is wild times. There would be no shtissel. Okay, so that was a wild interaction, right?
Yeah,
I think we were talking about movies.
We were talking about movies.
How did we get into Sholi Lamberger?
Why not?
It was a tangent. Movies. Ah, so during the pandemic, this is what I wanted to end off. Mendel, who was in the stroller when you met him, was studying in yeshiva. But it was pandemic, everything was Zoom. So I go into the bedroom and yeshiva is on mute, minimized in the corner, and he's watching like Transformers 17. So I figured, you know, if you're gonna watch movies during yeshiva in a global pandemic, you might as well watch good movies. So
agreed.
I said, Mendel, you got two choices. You either go back to yeshiva or you start binge watching the Godfather trilogy. He chose the Godfather trilogy. There was a scene in Godfather Part 2 which made me weep, and I called you. And being cinephiles, don't get nervous, listener. That's a term, right?
Yes.
Cinephile.
People who love cinema.
Right. Okay. So as a fellow cinephile, explain to the audience the pair scene of Godfather Part 2, which we just rewatched, by the way.
Okay. So Godfather Part 2 is one of the greatest sequels of all time, if not the best. And
besides Gremlins, what it does, the new batch.
Besides Gremlins, the new
batch. It has a whole Hammer horror. I know where you're going. I know where you're going with it.
Let's not get too far off.
Right.
So we have the first film, which tells us a linear story of the power of Godfather Vito Corleone being passed to his son, Michael Corleone.
Francis Ford Coppola.
Francis Ford Coppola co-wrote and directed and produced the film. And based on Mario Puzo's novel. And in the second film, which he made 2 years later, which, by the way, who does this? The movie wins Best Picture in 1972. 2 years later, he makes a sequel. The sequel wins Best Picture. Who does that? It's crazy. Anyway, so Godfather 2. So in the movie, since it's not just a straight narrative, you get a flashback to younger Vito Corleone, the history of the Corleone family, in the turn of the century, early Lower East Side, Little Italy, in New York City.
Genius.
And
they don't go forward.
Yes.
They go back and forward.
Back and forward.
Genius.
Because
so you see father and son at the same age, like
interlocked. Yes. Because you also get Michael in the 1950s.
Oh, I could cry.
And he's dealing with the Cuba situation.
Right.
And
the gaming license.
The gaming license, correct.
I'll tell you what I want.
And so you see the family coming together.
I'll pay nothing.
In the pack. And you see the family falling apart. And it's gorgeous. So you talked about the pair scene. In a flashback with Robert De Niro as young Vito Corleone, which he won Best Supporting Actor for.
Right. Sepia toned.
One of the only times, by the way, that two actors have won a Oscar for the same role.
Really?
You have Marlon Brando and Robert De Niro, both winning for Vito Corleone in the first and second Godfather. And you have two Jokers also. That Joaquin Phoenix won Best Actor for Joker, and Heath Ledger won Best Supporting Actor for The Dark Knight, playing the Joker.
Like Trivia Night over here.
Trivia Night, yeah.
Okay.
Now people are learning how annoying it is to be around us when we're talking about movies. The pair scene, you have young Robert De Niro as Vito Corleone. He's working in a market. And the Don, the man who runs the whole Little Italy, Don Finucci, comes into the market and he expects double his payment now, and that his nephew needs a job, and so the owner of the shop needs to give the job to this nephew. And so Robert De Niro's Vito gets fired as a result of this. And he's very gracious in his firing, and the owner of the market wants to, you know, give him a gift basket as a going away and all that kind of thing, and he doesn't accept it. But what he does do is he comes home with a single pair.
Wrapped up.
And he brings it to his wife. Very simple, very beautiful. They're just a young couple. They have nothing at this point. And he doesn't mention that he got fired. He doesn't go into a whole thing. He puts down a single beautiful pair on the table. And his wife says, "What a nice pair."
Oh.
And they sit down to dinner together.
Oh.
It's gorgeous and it's beautiful and it's this small, small thing. And that's been a touchstone for my wife and I all these years as well. She's not a big movie person. She's not a big Godfather person. But the reference of such a nice pair, that's something that we share with each other because it means something to me and it means something to her now as well.
Right. So I think it reminds us that there was a generation, and I think, you know, we live in what life is lived forwards but understood backwards, and I think as cinephiles and film historians, I think we kind of have a love of history, that there was a generation not too long ago when bringing home a pair meant something. And we live in a very disposable time, a disposable age, and everything is binged, and when I was a kid, binging was a bad thing, but apparently now it's the thing. The fact that this pair meant so much And he did not feel the need to bring home the pain of losing a job. I'm sure he told his wife later on, but he didn't want to ruin that meal, and the soup bowls are out. And it was so... And do you remember the angle is used? It's like a long shot, right, of the two of them.
Right.
I believe they held hands. He kisses her. It's... Oh,
you're looking at it through the doorway, which is a contrast to the end of the first Godfather, where the door closes on Kay, on Michael's wife at that time. And you see in Godfather 2 how they're divorced and they're fighting and they hate each other and all of these things. And that...
I feel nothing for you at this moment, Michael.
Exactly. And that's a huge contrast to that pair scene. So you asked me
intimacy,
for... You asked me for a pun. So it's very simple that... Vito and his wife in that moment are united, and family is the unity of the family is what makes the Godfather work. So they are a nice pair.
Beautiful.
As opposed to Michael and Kay.
Right. Wow.
Yeah.
I'm tingling. The audience is sleeping, but I'm tingling. It's a beautiful moment. It's a beautiful movie. It's a beautiful friendship. I can't like end a podcast with me and you because nothing ends. Like we just keep evolving and
growing.
There'll
be a sequel.
We have shared at this point thousands of like Shabbat meals.
I can't even count.
Hundreds of holidays and simchas and joys. There's been tears. There's been beers. One of my cheesy phrases, but they're cheesy. I kind of mean it. That you know, there are friends and there are family and there are friends that become family. Or as I say, family. So you are family, embedded, ingrained in my heart and my soul. I love you. I will always love you. And thank you for coming over today. We're only doing this because you came over to help me, like, put the right wires in the road. What's it called? The Roadmaster?
Yeah.
You helped me with the Roadmaster. So, and we figured,
Roadmaster sounds like a Patrick Swayze movie.
That would be...
Roadhouse,
which is not a great movie, to be honest. So is there any parting thoughts for the listener on the Hipsid Pod, which is, I'm sure for you, the highlight of your... We haven't even spoke about what you've been doing professionally over the years. You want to give a quick 2-minute synopsis?
I finished film school, and I've been working in film ever since, making
Beautiful.
Movies. And
what's been the highlight?
I don't know. I've had a lot of ups and downs over the years. Some high highs, some low lows. No, it's the truth.
Right.
When you work in the creative field, it's, you know,
right.
It's hard.
Right.
There was a point where I felt like I truly had a lot going for me, a couple times. And one of those times was when I got to film Punk Jews with you.
Oh my God, that was
and
fun.
We went to Comic-Con together.
Yes.
And we got to just have fun.
Yes.
And make a movie out of it. And so that to me is a true highlight. Because working with your friends and making something creative is literally the pinnacle of what I do.
Aw. Soul. Stop it. Okay, closing thoughts. We are now, emerging from the waters are subsiding of the global Pani D, as I like to say. What are your thoughts post Pani D? And hopes, aspirations, dreams for the future? How can we repair this fractured world and bring the world to a heightened state of consciousness? Hasten, this is for Rabbi Raskin, the immediate arrival of the Mashiach. You have kids now in Rabbi Raskin's school that you attended sort of as a kid in college. That's kind of cool.
It is weird, especially because the Rebbetzin at the shul that you used to run is a woman who I remember as a child.
Right,
like, so I remember
the
shul
that we founded,
child.
And right. Now Chaya and Yossi are kind of day to day on the ground. I'm still around the campus, around the neighborhood, but Ariella was Chaya's teacher. How about that?
When she was
in the school your kids attend.
Yeah.
So it's all starting to feel very Godfather too.
The older you get, the more stories you have.
Right.
The more history you have.
Right.
So all I can say.
Raskin comes home with a pair. comes home with a pair. No, Raskin would be an Etrog, though. He'd put like an Etrog down.
Such a nice Etrog.
Right, right.
So all I can say is I want to be around. I want to have the ability to keep creating things, and hopefully people will be healthy, and hopefully we can find common ground in a sane way and be happy with each other. I don't like people arguing, but I also feel like a lot of people are just losing their minds without going into too much detail.
Yeah, let's not do that.
What I'm really trying to say is that I want to see people healthy, and I want to make this world a healthy place. And I'm not a doctor. I don't work in the medical field. I don't work in politics. I don't work in any of this stuff. I'm a guy who makes movies. So all I can do is try to teach you something about yourself and the world in the process of you being told a story. And so hopefully we can do that. Hopefully I can inspire you in the future. Hopefully the world will, through myself or more importantly, other creators who are greater than I, understand ourselves better in this process.
Wow. On that bombshell, this is me, Rabbi Simcha, host of the Hipsid podcast, the roadmaster.
It's the roadmaster.
The dials have now been fine-tuned, and Saul has explained to me over a two-hour tutorial how to work the roadmaster. Apparently, I hit record when I'd like to record, and then hit record again when I would like to stop recording.
Yeah, and so I'm expecting a phone call in the near future.
Oh yeah, you're going to get one, yes. So we're now going to depart this podcast, and I want to thank you, Saul, for your friendship, for your love, for your brotherhood. Thank you to Elke, to the kids, to your families, to Elke's family. It's a love fest.
It's a love fest.
And it continues to grow like a peach. It continues to...
to be...
Shalom, shalom.